and welcome to Circle Sanctuary Network Podcasts, brought to you by Circle Sanctuary, one of the oldest nature spirituality churches in the United States, connecting people of nature-centered paths around the world. Join us through the week for a variety of shows discussing various topics, celebrating the divine in all of its forms through nature worship, rituals, education, and building bridges of community.
Good evening, good morning, good night. Good second breakfast, whenever you are, wherever you are. My name is Laura Gonzalez, and I'd like to welcome you to Lunatic Mondays, the very first bilingual show for CSNP, the Circle Sanctuary Network podcast. Tonight, we have a very special show with Dr. Jean Shinoda Bolan. Jean Shinoda Bolan, MD, is a psychiatrist, Jungian analyst, an internationally known speaker, an author of 13 influential books in over 100 foreign editions, The Tao of Psychologies, Goddesses in Every Woman, Gods in Every Man, Ring of Power, Crossing to Avalon, Close to the Bone, Goddesses in Older Women, Crones Don't Whine, The Millionth Circle, Like a Tree, Origin Message from Mother, Moving Toward the Millionth Circle, and Artemis, the Indomitable Spirit of In Every Woman. She's a Distinguished Life Fellow of the American Psychiatric Association, a past clinical professor of psychiatry, University of California, San Francisco, and a former board member of the Miss Foundation for Women, the Association for Transpersonal Psychology, and the C.G. Jung Institute of San Francisco. She is a 2020-21 Lifetime Achievement Award honoree from Markin's Who's Who, and you can find more of her work on her website, jeanbolan.com. I am so thrilled and so happy to have you here, Dr. Jean. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a real pleasure because all of my books have been translated into Spanish, and I have been to many Spanish-speaking countries, and I wish I could speak in Spanish, but you'll have to make do with my English.
We are very thrilled to have you in the show, and we know your work. We have read a number of your books, and I'm very proud to say that I have actually read your books because, Dr. Jean, you don't know this. It's really hard for me to read, and I'm a listening learner, and that's why I do podcasts, because I learn better from hearing the person. So yes, I have read your books. They are fantastic, and I am so very thrilled to have you here. I know I've said it many times already. Where does the inspiration come? And I'm going to take you way, way back to the first edition of Goddesses in Every Woman. It's a book that has helped so many people to understand themselves and understand the relationships they have with their environment, with their spouses, significant others, but most importantly, to understand the deep layers of their personality. How did you get the inspiration to write that book?
Well, you know, that book goes way back. It's been its 30th anniversary edition, but it came out actually in 1984. So it's a kind of classic book now. It's taught in a lot of different places. And I started out with another book in mind. I started out talking about the two different paths that women could take to develop. And one of them was based on Aphrodite, and the other one was based on Artemis and the two Greek goddesses that are quite different. And then I thought, well, but there are other classical Greek goddesses. And so I started to investigate, read, and realize that the Greek goddesses happen to be patterns, recognizable patterns. They don't have names when we get them. I mean, each of us comes into the world not as a blank screen, but as a personality. You pick up a baby, and there's a difference between a quiet, peaceful baby or a very active baby that just wants to grab things and hold on to things and move. So you start to realize that we start off in the world, either more introverted or extroverted, more emotional or more up in our minds or something. And so I started to see the patterns. And because I am a psychiatrist and because I'm a Jungian analyst as well, I started to see the different patterns. And what was fascinating is that we do know them all because it's part of our human inheritance. And so when I then went on to write Gods in Every Man, I found now I knew all of the goddesses because I can recognize them in myself as well as in other people. Now, could I recognize them in myself as well? And the answer turned out to be, yes, every woman also will have a masculine part of herself. And they differ too. It's not a standard masculine. It's this particular kind of masculine. Like what I'm doing right now is not a goddess. There isn't a goddess that likes to communicate and send ideas out into the world or likes to travel to different places. I do. Well, that's Hermes, the messenger god. So there's a kind of wonderful way of learning about patterns. And here the Greeks came along and they talked about them as gods and goddesses. And almost every single one of them happened to have certain characteristics that are always recognizable, but they also have a shadow side. They also, with one exception, one goddess did not have a shadow side. And she is the least known of the major goddesses in Greek mythology. And this is Hestia, goddess of the hearth and temple. All the other gods and goddesses have mythologies and they get into the human kinds of difficulties, you know, power oriented or relationship, sexual oriented or whatever. But here's Hestia, quiet, quiet Hestia presence, who doesn't have a whole bunch of mythologies about her that have to do with all the gods, the whole Greek stories. She was personified as a fire in the center of the round hearth. Now, if you can imagine back when there was no electricity, you'd go either home into your home, and until there was a fire in the hearth, it's a pretty cold, dark place. You go to a temple, and maybe there's some magnificent Greek statues, but unless there's a fire in the hearth, the temple doesn't seem to be much of a temple. Because there's something about Hestia's quiet fire. She doesn't catch things on fire. She doesn't, but she's there in the home providing, you know, the hearth is a place where you can feel safe at home. You come in from outside. And the hearth is also where back in the day, you can imagine that especially in a fairly small a place where people lived, that you'd also cook on it too. So it's a nourishment, it's a fire that warms and nourishes as a metaphor. And the same goes for a temple. You go into a temple space in, like I often walk in near woods in California where these magnificent redwoods are. And one of the favorite places I go into is called Cathedral Grove. Well, whether it's a grove of old growth redwood trees or whether it is walking into Grace Cathedral or Chartres Cathedral, there's a sense of looking up and feeling a sense of presence and quiet. This is Hestia, and she is actually, of all the goddesses, she was the one that I got the most thank you notes from women because nobody seemed to recognize this quiet presence, this person who could make a house a home, but she's not all into relationships. She's not all into, and she's not at all into power. She's into creating a space that is like the still point in us.
Mm-hmm. That is beautiful that you speak about the redwoods and the cathedral and the spirituality, and obviously I myself, a priestess of the goddess, this show dedicated to paganism, neo-paganism, and spirituality, earth-based religions. How important is for humanity, from a psychological point of view, to have a recognition of spirit and a lived spirituality, in your opinion?
Well, I know from my work, which is that people come to see a psychiatrist because they are very unhappy. They are depressed, they're anxious, they're afraid. Maybe they're even hearing voices. Life is not very peaceful inside their psyche or their soul. So I get how people need to find that stillness that we come into the world with. And the question about our connection to the kinds of places in the world that you can also enter and find peace. And it's like each of us has some kind of internal compass that recognizes in ourselves whether we're in the right place with the right person, with the right, I mean, not everybody is a nature-oriented woman or man, for example. I happen to be one, and it has had to do with finding, as a Girl Scout, how wonderful it was to be asleep under the stars. I was living in Los Angeles at the time, which is which also was where smog probably was invented almost. The word was, by the way, I think invented by people who lived in Los Angeles. And so, of course, you didn't see the Milky Way when you lived in Los Angeles, but you go up into the mountains to summer camp, Girl Scout camp, and amazing. First of all, it's gorgeous. And the quality in human beings that recognizes beauty, there's a reverence for beauty in nature. Nature has created some wonderful things. And people need to let it in, you know. Too many people go out and just, I see them in murals, they're too busy talking and taking pictures of the trees. Why don't they just feel what it's like to be among these ancient wise ones? Or, you know, as I did as a Girl Scout, to go to sleep under the stars and to recognize that this is amazing, this world we live in.
Mm-hmm.
And this, by the way, is the archetype of Artemis. Artemis was the goddess of the hunter and the goddess of the moon, and her realm was the wilderness. She is the goddess as an archetype. If you have Artemis and her other name is Diana in Latin and Roman mythology. So in Greek mythology, she is Artemis, and she, as goddess of the wilderness and as archetype, she doesn't want to just go where everybody goes on paved roads. She wants to go into the wilderness and discover things. And also she has a connection with nature and with the young and the vulnerable. Back in Greek days, she was the sort of patron goddess of little girls. And they were called Artemis's little bears until they reached the age where they lost their independence, actually, and became like suitable for marriage. But Artemis is an archetype that is still very much in me. And my last book actually just focused on Artemis, because she is also related to almost all the goddesses, have a genealogy of sorts too. So anyway, I've roamed a bit in response to your question, but that's very Artemis-y too.
And I love, I was told long, long time ago by my sister, when speakers roam is when you get the golden nuggets. So don't be mindful about Roman, because that's what we want.
Okay.
And another piece of your vast collection that I love, and I am by no means yet on Crone Age, but I believe sometimes we tap into the maiden, the mother of the Crone as archetypes. Crones Don't Whine. It's a book I live by. And of course, it's also, I believe, inspired by the mythology, but I have the author here. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what inspired Crones Don't Whine? Because that is a delightful book.
Well, I wrote Goddesses and Older Women, and I started out by saying, after I wrote Goddesses and Every Woman, people asked, Well, what about Hecate, an older goddess? And I used to think, but I'm not old enough. I don't know Hecate that well. And so when I was old enough, I wrote Goddesses and Older Women. And Crones Don't Whine is actually a book that describes that whole phase of being over 50, but doesn't use any of the words, maybe one here and there, but it doesn't describe things as archetypes, as goddess patterns or anything. It's just a straightforward, small, slenderish book. Well, the book's about the major archetypes. I have to tell this whole story about the goddess mythology and what the archetype in a person is, and then how it shows up in a woman herself. So it's a fatter book, and it's more intellectual. Well, Crones Don't Whine, which I was delighted when my Spanish publisher said, well, we don't have a word for crones. So we translated it to say, witches don't complain. I was just very much amused by the translation into witches don't complain. And the idea that when you get old enough to move into that period, postmenopausal period, and this is where a lot of women become very bitter about how other women seem to have it so much better. How come I didn't have a bigger house? How come I wasn't able to have the child I wanted? How come I didn't get the education? How come I had the parents I had? How come? And so you enter the crone age years and you're getting to be a bitter, envious woman. But not if you have the wise woman archetype as part of you. Not if there's a sense that this is an initiation. You are now going from one stage to the next. And the question about is, will you enter your wisdom years? Will you have learned from your suffering? Do you know that you cannot get through life without your share of suffering? It goes with being human. So you can become narrower and bitter, or you become deeper and wiser and more connected with the suffering of other people in the world. So there's something about, you know, when we come into the world, we come in to a world that we are totally dependent on other humans or we won't survive, because we come in as a vulnerable baby and we have no control over where we are, if we're going to eat, if we're going to be warm, any of that. So if we survive that, it's because no matter what it was like, we survived it because somebody loved us, somebody took care of us and brought us into our next stages of our life. Well, to get into the phase of being a older woman, one of the things is to appreciate an awareness about how, if you weren't so caught up in your own self, if you weren't so narcissistically oriented toward me, you started to recognize how, for example, back in the day when you were in high school, say, there was a certain classification of people, but as you got to know them better, you realize if you were open to really meeting them at a soul level or as a heart level, that they have their share. They may look like their lives are really good, but basically people suffer loss. Bad things happen, but good things also happen. And so by the time we get to be postmenopausal, it's when we can move into the age of the crone, but maiden, mother, crone, the three phases of the great goddess, are always present in women at any stage. So maiden or child, I still have my child and my maiden. They're quite strong in me, as a matter of fact. And then there is maiden, and then mother is the same as, it, for me, mother is just one of the adult archetypes. Not every woman has to be a mother. In fact, a lot of women would do better not being mothers, because what they want to do is academic, what they want to do is, and so if you have choice, which this is one of the things, we, for us to become an egalitarian rather than a patriarchal culture, women have to have autonomy and choice over the basic kind of thing about having a child, because they want to be a mother, because their archetype in them is fulfilled by being a mother. But then another woman has hardly any mother archetype at all. And what she really wanted to do but couldn't do was be really educated. Perhaps she could have been an Athena at another time, because that's her archetype. And in any kind of other world, she would have, she loved school, she would have gone up the academic ladder, she'd be a PhD, she'd be a research scientist, she would be, because her mind is what it, what she really, what really intrigues her, not having babies. So when women can actually have a choice of what they can do with their one, there's a favorite poet of mine, Mary Oliver, at the end of a poem called A Summer Day, she says, "Doesn't everything die at last and too soon? Tell me, what do you plan to do with your one wild and precious life?" Well, you know, precious is obvious in any language. But wild is that word that has to do with like a forest that hasn't been logged. It what you, it's what you naturally came into the world with. It could have been your intellect. It could be a real talent because you're an athlete naturally. It could be that you had a natural maternal instinct and so you liked to play with dolls when you were three. Whatever it was that you came into the world was that which was not worked over. It's still part of your nature. I mean, nature and wild do kind of go together. So when I think about Mary Oliver's poem, what do you plan to do with your one wild and precious life? And one of the things about getting older is to sense that time has gone by awfully fast. Life is precious. Maybe I am 84 now. I'm thinking, wow, how did I get to be this old so fast? One of the things. But the other thing is that you then begin to realize that each day is precious and what you do with it matters. And will you tap into what you want to do from inside out with your one wild and precious life, or will you be trying to please other people and become who they wanted you to be? And so many families do this, especially to their girls. You are to be who we want you to be. And then if you automatically get into the marriageable age, you're supposed to conform to who would want to marry you, so you better emphasize those. And then when you get married, it's like pleasing. Now you have two families to please, the one that you came from and the one that he came from and him. Now, how much are you going to shape your life because other people value certain qualities in yourself, but really suppress everything else? And so sometimes it's not until you really get into the third phase of life and you tap into the crone wisdom that realize, you know, this life has gone by very fast and time is very precious, and what I want to do is not what everyone expects me to do, but this other thing. Mm-hmm. And when you do, what you find is a spark, a new area of growing into who you could become. And that makes for, well, it's your own creativity. You're creating who yourself in a sense.
That is so beautiful. Everything you've shared with us, it really is a delight and a jewel to have you on the podcast tonight. Before we go on a break, I want to ask something. Because when you talk about like a tree, you talk about Gloria Steinem, and you talk about being in California all these years, and of course, writing all these wonderful books. Have you seen changes from the beginning of the women's liberation movement to now? Or do you think we have moved the needle very, very little?
Oh, there's been, in the United States, major changes. And we are in the middle of this coronavirus pandemic. And the death rate, the infection rate, they're both really, really high. And what's interesting is watching, you know, we're tracking it on television and seeing who is speaking. The hospital staff, there are so many women doctors who are in the emergency rooms, and women nurses, but women doctors were not around in the numbers that they are. And there's diversity too. Maybe it's because of the diversity rather than going into private practice, a number of women doctors or women of color, for example, that are on the front lines. And they are the physicians that are taking care of the patients that are going to live or die in that emergency room. And I was amazed at how many women doctors there are. And then I noticed that when they interviewed a certain states that have tensions within it and stuff, it's not always, there are a number of women governors, women mayors, not as well as women doctors. And that is new. It's like the, back in the day, I mean, at the end of the 1960s, that's when the Ms. Magazine, Gloria Steinem, when the women's movement, first it was called the Women's Lib Movement, and then it became the Women's Movement, and then it started to move internationally. And so in the end of the 60s, it was clearly the birth of the women's movement. And then the 1970s became the decade of women. And then there was a backlash. And because we started to use Ms. rather than Miss or Mrs. Because with Miss or Mrs., you were defined by your relationship to a man. And if you got married, it was Mrs., say, George Cortez or something like that. It was his name.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than your name that you came into the world with. And of course you also got your father's name when you were born back then too. But it was your name. It was a name that you were used to using, and then you moved through and so here in the 70s it was an era of Ms. And then there was a backlash. And then it got kind of quiet. And I think during that time, a lot of women got educated and did things quietly. And now in this coronavirus pandemic, it's like, there they are. They're in positions of importance. And in the United States, the election of 2018 for the House of Representatives was amazing. More women, more diverse women, Muslim, there's a Muslim women, there are Mexican Americans, there are Black women, there are Asian women. And now we're facing the next election, which will determine actually probably the soul of America. And we don't know yet. I have actually great faith that we will come through without our current president, who is so much of a problem that it's mobilizing so many people. And even if there's corruption in counting votes and things, there probably will be a sufficient number of people to overwhelm that. But then I am an optimist, but then I'm also feeling the surge of something new coming into culture. And I wrote a book called The Mayan Circle, How to Change Ourselves and the World. And it's a very, very thin little book. And then I wrote another one called Moving Towards the Million Circle, which is also a very slender little book. Because if you form a woman's circle with a sacred center, symbolic center, whatever it is, and when you are in circle, every person in the circle is an equal and has an opinion or something to share or ask for prayers or something. Hierarchy means is very different. Hierarchy is you, the person at the top that has always up to now been a man sets the tone and everybody says yes. In fact, the current president of the United States has just those kind of people under him. Go along with me or you're out. And what they do is sell their soul. But this is sort of what women have done in patriarchy all along. Because to survive, you had to have a man. Otherwise, you were an outcast. And to be an outcast and a woman is a dreadful position to be on the street equivalent. So you'd better not complain, et cetera, you know?
Yes. It is wonderful to hear your perspective on everything. We are going to take a short break and we'll be back with more here on Lunatic Mondays with Dr. Jean Shinoda-Bolan. Don't go anywhere.
I am the goddess mother of life. I am the goddess bearer of life. I am the goddess divine. I am
listening to Lunatic Mondays, building bridges of community around the world. We'll continue with more. Don't go anywhere. And we're back here with Dr. Jean. Dr. Jean, there was something that you mentioned when we invited you to do this podcast about dandelions and the seeds and how the pandemic has inspired you to say yes. Why do you think it's so important that we take the leap of faith and connect in this virtual work, virtual world, to say yes and to spread the word in a new way.
Well, it's an amazing change. I have taken and used the word liminal, which is not a word that is used very often, but it happens to be the precise word for what the nature of the time we are in now. That is, liminal was a word that came out of Latin that had to do with a threshold. When you went from outside to inside, you crossed over the threshold. When you went from one major room to another room, often there would be either a doorway you went through, or maybe there would be a hallway you went through to get to the next place. So liminal means threshold or between space, between what was, between where you used to be and where you're going to go next. But in a psychological sense, in the way we are in time right now, with the coronavirus pandemic, with the wildfires that are happening in California, with the cutting of the rainforest in Brazil, with whatever is going on, we can't go back. You can't go back to what was. It's changed. We are in this in-between time. In the United States, we're approaching very shortly. We're already at 180,000 deaths. We'll probably hit 200,000 deaths pretty shortly. Well, you can't go back to bring them back. They're gone. And we don't know where we're going next. We've got our major political elections coming up, but families are going through that. Every single death means that some family has been affected by that death. What do you do in this in-between place, liminal time? What I am doing is what I call the dandelion effect. I had a schedule of traveling to places and giving talks and whatever, but you know, mostly they were to organizations that they may have been big conferences, but they were all sort of kinship, sort of like if they were psychiatrists or Jungian analysts or whatever, and everything got shut down with being sheltered in place. So right now what I'm doing is I'm talking from my home. I'm continuing doing a practice in psychiatry and Jungian analysis, but I'm doing it virtually. And since I am not traveling, and thank goodness, travel got to be really a pain and going through all, having to get there so much ahead of time, having to go through all the lines, having to be in big airplanes full of too many people. I mean, it's very nice actually to be able to do what I had set out to do, which is to communicate an idea or ideas or support people, especially women, to become who they could become. That's been sort of my work. And now what happens is that I'm invited by you, invited by others to talk. And I think of it as the dandelion effect, because it's like blowing on a dandelion, each one carrying a seed, and it goes out carried by the winds, only I think of it as the internet winds, and it goes and it can land in a fertile soil, meaning it lands in somebody's psyche, and that person starts to think about something that they might not have thought about. Maybe they didn't have a word for it, like liminal. Liminal is a special word, that you are in between who you used to be and who you could become. So what are you going to do when you're sheltered in place? You know, you can go to almost any university online. You can learn whatever you really wanted to learn. You can start to rethink what you are going to be doing next. So it's an amazing time. Liminal is also the time, you know, when you are in the when you're being born. You've been nicely sheltered in the womb of your mother, in the uterus of your mother, and then there's something that happens, and it's like the uterus starts to contract. You drop down into the the floor of the uterus, and you're becoming aware that you're going to be pushed through a kind of narrow place. And this is a liminal time. This is like threshold between inside the mother and outside into the world. And this is a time of danger and opportunity, which is the Chinese pictograph for crisis. So this is why I'm saying the pandemic crisis brings in danger and opportunity. Yes, it may kill someone close to you, or if you don't put a mask over, if you don't respect the coronavirus, and you listen to people that say, oh, it's a hoax or something like that, well, it may kill you, or you may be infected and you may kill people close to you.
Mm-hmm.
It's a crisis, danger, but
yes.
Opportunity.
I'm very thrilled that you explained in such depth the word liminal and have given us this word, because once we have a definition, we can grasp the concept and then we can understand and say, okay, so I have this liminal space. What am I going to do with it? What am I going to do after? What I've been telling people about the pandemic and all the pain and all the changes that have been happening with ecology, with women's rights, with people of color's rights, with the riots, the marches, and the pandemic is, it feels very much like a birth. We're mm-hmm. birthing a new life.
Right.
And it comes with pain and it comes with violence, mm-hmm. you know, because every birth has that crisis.
It's a mess too, you know. When I as part of an internship, I delivered a lot of babies. I enjoy delivering babies. But, you know, it's a mess when the baby comes out.
Yes.
But the problem is there's a danger. When the baby goes under the pubic bone of the mother, that baby can be stuck. And in a country or a culture in which she can't have good medical care that involves, if a baby gets stuck, maybe she'll need a C-section. But if there's no C-section, then she and the baby are likely to die. So there's a true danger and opportunity as you move through this liminal time into the world as a baby and as a new mother, especially if this is your first time you've been pregnant, the first time you've born a child. Will you survive? A lot of women die in childbirth. And a lot of babies die in childbirth too.
Yes.
So liminal is full of amazing potential, but it also is a time of danger. And that's where we are as humanity. This mm-hmm. is a time when humanity could change enormously. And it requires an egalitarian bringing of masculine and feminine values and choices and no more power over just because you're one gender.
Indeed. I have heard you before. I cannot believe we are just about 10 or 15 minutes to end the show, but I have heard before the story of what inspired you to write Like a Book. And I have
been like a tree.
Like a tree. I have had the pleasure to hear you say the story. So I want to share that story with our audience tonight. So would you tell us how you were moved to write Like a Tree?
Well, when I first saw the house that I've now lived in for since 1992, I didn't see the house. I saw the tree in front of the house. And so that was part of my home, was this Monterey pine tree. And a neighbor, who now had windows on her side of her house. I live in a place where all the houses were created to look at the view outward, and we could see the bay, San Francisco Bay. So this woman had her house remodeled, put in these windows on the side, and now she had to look at this tree rather than be able to see vistas. And so I belong to an association of homeowners. And it got to be a political issue, as political issues happen. And essentially for about a year, I supported not having this tree cut down because she wanted it cut down. And then I went to New York knowing that I'd lost, that it was going to be scheduled to be cut down. And interestingly, when I was away, and I was going to the United Nations, where I have been an activist since 2002 at the UN. And I was doing something with Gloria Steinem, had invited her to speak at a panel I was doing at the UN. And she's an old friend from way back who came, we got to be friends because she came to, I thought of her, the big sister that came to rescue, to speak and help me with the American Psychiatric Association a long time ago. But anyway, so here she is. We did our thing, and I told her my sad story, that when I get home, this tree's going to be cut down. And she said to me, "Jean, remember, you are a writer. You can have the last word." So those words rang in my mind, and I came back and I saw the stump of the tree. And I started to write the book like a tree, and it came out of it. What came out of it was interesting because, see, back in the day when I was pre-med, I didn't take botany. I took all those physiology courses and chemistry courses that were requirements to go to medical school. I never had taken botany or just plain biology. And so I learned about what kind of tree it was, and a lot of things, and in the process of learning and appreciating, first of all, I got over my anger, and I got into what trees really do for us. And then one of the things that happens sometimes when you are on course, you're doing something from your heart, and you're totally involved in it. And it wasn't to get even or anything. By the time I got into knowing about trees and all, I was just centered in my writing. And what happens when that happens is what I call synchronicity, or what Jung called synchronicity. Coincidences. I started hearing stories that I just put into the book. Yes, I wrote the book, but the material required so little research because I told a lot of people stories happened to tell them to me as I was writing the book. So that's how, like a tree, how trees, women, and tree people can save the planet was the title of the book. It happens to be the first book that will come out in a new edition, soft cover edition in the United States at the end of this year, beginning of next year. And the pandemic has happened in between. And in between, I realize that the subtitle of the book needs to be, you know, the planet can take care of herself. So it no longer is how trees, tree people, and women can save the planet, but how trees, tree people, and women can save us. And that's because men and women are tree people. Not all women are tree people, because the neighbor next door was a woman. But the men who are, and I write about people like Julia Butterfly Hill, about the men who supported her as she was up in the tree to prevent old growth redwoods from being cut down, that the men who are part of the environmental movement are tree people. There are lots of us. It isn't a gendered thing. But however, women do have a capacity in having both right and left brain, more fibers. We are actually the gender that are more whole people, more naturally, if we were allowed to develop who we are. So that's a long bit of a story about how Like a Tree came into being.
I have a theory, and I guess a lot of people might have that theory as well, about eco-activism and eco-spirituality and how humans have harmed the earth so much, because the earth is seen as female.
Mother Earth, Father Sky.
And the earth has just been treated as second class, and we are so wrong, you know. What if you could adventure yourself with your optimism and with your wisdom? If you could see in a crystal ball what the future holds after we move from this liminal space into what the world will be after COVID, or after we find a cure or a vaccine or a way to contain this crisis that we're going through, what would you think will come in the new world?
Well, this liminal time is not just, we happen to be halted by the coronavirus. And the vaccine and all of that will probably take another year, but the liminal time that we are in is going to be longer than that. It's a time when the optimism that I have is with the possibility of focusing on trees and women, the two elements that would make all the difference to keep this beautiful blue planet, which is our mother, the Earth, alive. The planet's atmosphere is like the placenta is to a baby in the womb of the mother. That is, it is the trees and the placenta that bring oxygen to humanity or to the baby and takes the waste away. The placenta does that to that individual baby in the womb. But if we continue to cut down all the trees, or most of the trees, the model is Easter Island, which was a island in the middle of the Pacific that had too many people, and they cut down all the trees, and with that, it didn't survive. Just a few people survived, and was found when the explorers came or something. But for us to survive, it is a matter of truly letting boys and girls grow into who they could be. It means that women have to have reproductive rights, so that right now we have too many people and not enough trees. And that is responsible for global warming, and that is responsible for the wildfires that now become so easy to happen. So we get into this crisis stage where we clearly have not enough trees, too many people. And what are we going to do next? What are we going to do? Well, one of the things, the model of Circle is that it's no longer the men at the top that get to tell all of us what we're supposed to do. And it will take one or two generations, but that's no time at all in terms of Mother Earth's history. It has to do with having a sense of reverence for where we are and appreciation and gratitude. I mean, I remember in the late 60s when we first saw the image of Earth from outer space, and that was before there was pollution over the major cities like now. In fact, one of the wonderful things about the pandemic over India is for the first time, people in India, because they were in lockdown, the smog and smoke over the city, the big cities, went away, and they could see the Himalayas for the first time. So to see the Earth from outer space, when we first saw her, she was beautiful. We didn't see smog over places. She was this beautiful blue planet with the white swirls of clouds and peeking through some, the planets. And to value our mother, the earth, and see her against the void of space and realize it's the only, this is home, that we have to take care of her, which means the atmosphere, which means that we have to take responsibility for not enough trees, too many people, which is a very simplistic formula, but essentially those are the two elements.
Mm-hmm.
And there are, like, there are the tree sisters in England, I believe. People are growing trees all over. So more trees, less, no unwanted children. And educate everybody to become who they could be, not who they're stereotypically have to be. When boys are allowed to have feelings and to the ones that have a natural nurturing element, when they're able to do that and not be called a sissy and not suppress it, then they will also grow up to have a symmetrical brain like women now can have, because they develop both sides of the brain, the logical left side of the brain, and the other one that can isn't logical, but carries imagination and pictures and music and things like that. So that's the big vision, is that take several more generations, and that would be possible. And the pandemic has made us aware of our globalness. Now, nationalism also. Not only does patriarchy power over have to go away in terms of the unit of the family, it needs to happen for the entire globe. Now, I don't know how many generations that will take, but you know, time is going by awfully fast for us as human beings.
Yeah. And I think, and I have faith that it will happen. And as you said so wisely before, the earth will contain herself and will heal herself, but if we are not smart, we're not going to heal with her. So we have to be smart. And I love to hear you talking about reproductive rights and wanted children, because a pregnancy should be wanted. A pregnancy should be desired. And earlier in the talk, when you were talking about Athena, and I was like raising my hand because, yeah, some of us are just not born to bear children, and it's okay, you know. Let's withdraw those patriarchal archetypes that women are walking incubators, and, you know, be more conscious of the whole of the world. Dr. Jean, it has been more than a pleasure. It has been literally a delight and a joy to hear you speak. I'm so very happy that you said yes and that you are using the Zandelein effect to bring the wisdom all over the world. And I would like to, first of all, thank you for being on the show tonight and ask you if there's any latest words that you would like to leave your audience tonight with.
It's been fun being on your program, and I've enjoyed meeting you, really, because I do feel this meet is a medium where I do have a sense of connection. And this is my website, www.jeanbolen.com. My current creativity is I put out a newsletter when I move to do so. And the past ones are also under newsletter. And I think this sort of thing gets translated into other languages. I'm not sure, but I've had an affinity for the Spanish speaking countries because I grew up in California, where Spanish and Mexican food is really quite, quite much at home. And to have a Spanish publisher who has published every single one of my books, it's the only, you know, I'm translated in a lot of editions in different countries, but it's only in Spanish where every single one of them has been translated.
Yes.
So, you know, and Spanish is a heart country, a heart language, et cetera. So thank you for the invitation.
Thank you so much for your kind words. And I'm going to have to ask you one last question. Since you like Mexican food, what's your favorite dish?
Oh, I used to make all the tacos myself. You know, tacos. And just fill it with all kinds of good things, and so I that's what I could cook myself.
Yes.
And still could do that. And but when I go to a restaurant, it might be a way that they made seafood taste absolutely delicious, or the enchiladas that are made with wonderful things.
Yeah.
And back in the day, I also used to really appreciate Mexican beer.
There you go. One of the finest beers in the world, indeed.
Mexican cerveza, beer. Right.
Cerveza. Absolutely. Dr. Jean, it has been a pleasure to have you. It truly is a milestone for me. I appreciate you being on the show. And for everyone who is listening, please go back to www.jeanbolland.com to find her books, to find her work, to find her activities. She's been very active. She's been sharing a lot of her wisdom on various online platforms. And I know a lot of those have been recorded. And if you haven't read her books, please, what are you waiting for? Y para los que hablan español, también, por favor, vayan a buscar todos los libros de la doctora Jean. Están todos en español. And in so many very other languages, all your books have been translated. So thank you. Thank you, thank you, thank you for being here tonight. And I wish you the best. And thanks.
And thank you for joining us on the Circle Sanctuary Network podcasts, presented by Circle Sanctuary and produced for all who follow the Nature Center paths. Join us here throughout the week for various programming connecting the community around the world. And please don't forget to watch for updates on the Circle Sanctuary website at www.circlesanctuary.org. And follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/CSNpodcasts. We can also be found on your favorite podcast hosting sites, such as iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, and others. And until next time, many blessings.